Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and I'm real glad that you decided to join us for episode 74 this week. You're in for a real treat. Me and my fellow podcaster over at the Fastball Special, Martin Slam Duncan, went on a little road trip for this episode. You may have heard me teasing it a couple months ago with Daft J of how I had a couple of interviews that I had set up that I was really excited to conduct. And thankfully to Martin Slam Duncan, we both teamed up. He arranged it for the interview to happen, and we drove out to Oakville, Ontario, and met up with professional comic book artist and illustrator, the incomparable Mike Ruth. Now, if you've been to any of the local conventions within the Greater Toronto area, or even throughout the United States, perhaps you went through Artist Alley and you saw this Viking-looking dude who looks extremely intimidating with this wonderful red beard down to his chest. And for the record, it's the best beard that you'll see in Artist Alley or in the comic book industry, for my money. So you'll see some awesome Conan artwork on his table. Beside the Conan, you might see a Red Sonja, some Viking artwork, maybe Ric Flair giving the figure four to an alien character because Mike's a big, huge wrestling fan. And it's just a lot of fun to go and visit his table in Artist Alley, chit-chat with him, ask him for a commission. He's an awesome dude, and I was so happy that me and Martin were able to travel down to his hometown. Just hang out with him for the afternoon. We went to, as you hear the podcast, the episode, you're going to hear the birds chirping. We're outside. We're by the lakeshore. It was just a great day. And hearing Mike open up just about a little bit of his history within the comic book industry, the hard work that it takes to get there, the ups and downs of being an illustrator. It's just, at the end of it all, you're really rooting for these guys to win. And based on his work ethic, and his passion for the art form, you know that any moment now, he's going to blow up big. Like, it's just, it's inevitable because the work is so good. And some of the credits that he's got to his name already include Chapter House Comics, Aftershock Comics, Image Comics. Now, to those who are more familiar with Marvel and DC, believe me, the work is fantastic. And you can't judge a book by its cover, but I bought Animosity based on the covers that I saw him putting together just for the variants. So we're rooting for him. He's one of the good guys. And thank you again to Martin Slam Duncan for helping organize it. Don't forget to check out thefastballspecial.com as well as on iTunes for more episodes and content from Mr. Slam Duncan himself. And look up Mike Ruth on his Facebook page. See some of the stuff that he's doing. It's fantastic. And if you do happen to come to a Comic-Con within the GTA, Fan Expo, or Niagara Falls Comic-Con, go check out Mike Ruth's booths. Tell him that the Fastball Special and the Cave of Solitude sent you. So for now, we'll leave you with this fantastic episode. Hope you enjoy it, and we will talk to you soon.
Okay, folks. We're here today with Eric Anthony from the Cave of Solitude podcast.
Hey, everybody. How's it going? Happy to be here with you once again.
And we have a very special episode today. We have the master illustrator, the Viking of the cons, Mr. Mike Ruth.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so today we're going to do a quick little interview. The first thing I'd like to know, Mr. Ruth, is everybody's got an origin story. So how did you sort of get started into this journey, this comic book journey? What are the things that sort of influenced you growing up? What did you like to read? And did that carry over into adulthood as well?
Yeah, well, definitely comics have played a huge role. I think my earliest memories are of watching my mother draw pictures for me. She was a natural talent with drawing. Never had any training or anything, but I think she kind of grew up in an era where maybe, you know, she didn't have the familial support that I've had growing up, because my parents have always encouraged my art, which I'm sure is a huge factor as well. But yeah, the origins of it are really watching my mom draw and bringing her my comics. Marvel comics, most of them, I'm sure, at the time, probably specifically Marvel 2-in-1 comics from the 70s with the Thing teaming up with various people from the Marvel Universe, which was my favorite comic. He's my favorite character. My mom hated drawing the Thing, but she would do it for me all the time because she knew that he's my favorite. And, you know, in Canada, we didn't get the action figures the kids had in the States. So, like, they already had, like, Fantastic Four and Marvel toys that we just didn't have here in Canada. So I remember they were like my first toys, my mom doing drawings of characters on things like, you know, the inside of a cereal box or like the cardboard backing that would come with a pair of socks or something like that, or ladies' knee highs, and I would draw on those, and she'd cut them out for me, and that was what my toys were. So it was that's where it began. And in terms of me drawing, though, it began there for sure. But when my little brother was born, my mom didn't have the time to draw for me as much, and so she actually would just say, "Oh, you just, you know, here's the stuff. Sit down and draw. Try drawing it yourself." So I had a lot of encouragement from the get-go, and that's when you start getting, I think, positive feedback as a kid about something that you're doing. Because I was no athlete. I didn't, you know, have 6 o'clock in the morning hockey practices or anything, things like that. I'm sure my dad would have loved it if I was a hockey guy, but my brothers were. So I was just kind of the comic book guy, I guess. But yeah, I always had them encouraging me to do art, so I kind of just always did that. I liked the feedback I would get. I remember being the kid in like grade 3 that could draw, grade 4 and grade 5, and you know, I'd get people ask me to draw them stuff, and we'd make up our own superhero characters, because back then it was like the early 80s and we had Marvel Universe handbooks, so we wanted to create our own entries for Marvel Universe handbooks with our own characters. You know, write up stats for them and stuff, and we'd all try to outdo each other with who had the most powerful stats and who had the best character. I had a character called Death Knight, who was just this ridiculous Hulk in full plate armor, which I should probably revisit one day. But yeah, it was super fun.
So did his stats go to 11?
I hadn't seen Spinal Tap at that point, so I don't think I got the joke. But yeah, it he was like, you know, class 100 strength is what they used to always be, right? The Hulk was class 100 strength and that kind of stuff. So anyway, yeah, kind of funny. But that's kind of where it began. And then in high school, I was kind of a nerdy kid. I didn't really play sports, and I grew up in a very sports-heavy, you know, hockey, lacrosse kind of town, as there's so many of them in Canada like that. And I went to a very jockey school, a school recognized for its sports achievements. But what I had no idea knowing in grade 8 when I was kind of viewing different high schools to check out was that the St. Catharines Collegiate actually had this incredible art program that had their entire fourth floor devoted to art. And they had painting studios and sculpture studios, and they had a photo lab and a dark room and all kinds of stuff. It was just incredible. So it was a tremendous blessing. And yeah, it was great. So that's certainly was a great place to nurture those skills.
So I remember the first time I met you, it was at a fan expo, and I came around the corner. It was in Artist Alley, and I see this magnificent banner. It was probably the most metal thing I've seen all day. and I come back, you know, I come from a background of, you know, reading old heavy metal magazines and Savage Sword of Conan and things like that. So I see this space Viking who's holding this giant spear chucking machine gun type thing, and I'm like, oh, this piques my interest. So I go down and then there's Mike, and you know, friendly as usual. And I start rummaging through his stuff, and he's got pictures, you know, wrestling sketches. He's got pictures of, you know, Conan, and then that just sort of hit it off right there. But there's certainly a style that you have. I noticed that a lot of your sketches and your drawings tend to be very inking centric or black and white centric. Is that something that you just prefer to work in that medium, or?
Well, when I began my career many years ago as an illustrator, I had been trained by an artist in Toronto for a while, and I also studied at Sheridan College for a few years. But I had learned to paint with gouache, and it's a medium that it's like an opaque watercolor, so it allows you to, you know, to work with the same kind of creaminess as like oil paint or something like that, but not have the washiness of watercolor, but it kind of have the best of both worlds. The only problem is rendering in that way with gouache is a time-consuming medium, and I was so hungry getting out of school and trying to do this for a living that I didn't really feel it was a medium that was really suitable for hitting deadlines. But as time went on, I kind of got woken up to a little bit more digital options, and when I was working for a children's book company, I started doing a lot of my coloring coloring digitally, and then I figured out I could also do drawing digitally once I got myself a Wacom bamboo tablet, which is actually the most high-tech thing I think I own, and I bought it 10 years ago. So, but it's yeah, it kind of changed how I thought about doing work under a deadline. So I moved away from traditional stuff and started doing digital. But then I had a massive system crash, and I lost over a month of work.
Wow.
On just a terrible, terrible day. And I basically at that point pushed it all away, pushed the computer away, and said, no, I want to do something that's more manageable. And just like in Conan the Barbarian, when Conan's father is talking to him about the sword, and he says to him, in this life you can't trust men, you can't trust women, you can't trust beasts, but he holds the sword and says you can trust this. And that's kind of immediately how I felt with regards to I knew that I could trust my brushes. And so I just started to pick up my brushes and start to play around with ink, and because I come from a bit of a painting training background, I just started to apply some wet-on-wet techniques and different watercolor techniques to ink, and I found that it was actually working out really well, and I was coming up with a look that not a lot of people were using at the time. A lot of people are using ink and wash now. Again, I'm not trying to say that I created that as a thing.
Right.
It's just, I was kind of the only guy with a can on his table with water for a little while at Comic-Cons. My enchanted maple syrup can, which comes with me to all my, all my comic shows. But, yeah, so I'm not sure. Did I answer the question? Or
yeah, absolutely. In ink you could trust.
Yes.
So you didn't briefly mention you were working for a children's book company.
Yes, I worked for a few years, for many years actually, for a company here in Oakville called Rubicon. But I also worked for some other book companies at the time, and Rubicon handled a lot of. English as a second language education books. So a lot of the graphic novels and things that I created for them were done as to assist new Canadians or to assist people who are struggling with reading. It was great, great work. But as with, all good things that came to an end, and I eventually started seeking out comic book stuff after that. I had lots of material, though, because I had done something like over 40 graphic novels in a 5-year span. So I 40 or 50 graphic novels. I have a whole stack of them at home, and about 1,000 pages of sequential art that no one's ever seen before, because it was all educational stuff. It was all stuff that was done for books, making things like Treasure Island or old stories where the English language has changed so much, it just turned them and made those things more accessible to kids who were having a hard time. Like a kid today learning nowadays English wouldn't be able to pick up the original script of Treasure Island and understand it. So that was kind of the point of those books. But yeah, it was great. Unfortunately, as with all things, when there's it did suffer for a little bit from the higher up positions questioning some of the content. I mean, it's difficult. It's a bit of a slippery area with all publishing, but certainly with children's publishing, things can't look a certain way, or they can suggest other things, which sounds really weird, so I'll clarify. Basically, it would be a case of where I would do a book that was historically based, and by drawing it historically, I may have to draw things like swords or shields or spears or axes or guns or things that may have appeared in that time, and then once the book was inked, colored, and delivered, I would get feedback saying, well, we have to take out all the guns. Or we have to take out all the spears. Or in the case of the pirate book, we had to take out all the Jolly Roger flags because the skull, even though it was basically casino graphics, the skull was essentially too evil.
Alternative facts.
Yeah, it made it really difficult. So eventually I would get so upset when these changes would have to be made, because I mean the work was already done, I've already been paid, now I have to go back and usually without pay make these revisions. They knew how upset it was making me, so they eventually just stopped telling me and they just hired someone to go ahead and make those changes. So I would get comps of my book 3 months after doing them, and I would see the book had all the swords and shields and everything removed from the book.
Did they tell that story then? Like, what?
Well,
does it make any sense?
Inaccurately, I guess, ultimately is the short answer. It was a shame because, it's hard to tell a story about World War II and then have none of the soldiers using guns. But all the soldiers were drawn as if they were holding guns. So to edit those, you have to remove the guns. And now everyone's basically pointing with their fingers like, hey, kind of like double finger point. and it just made it look really ridiculous, I think. And it's just a shame that, And weirdly, a lot of that was from the American publishers who would be taking the stories that we're doing and distributing them in the States. So you'd have a situation where some American higher up at a company like Scholastic or a place like that would say, no, we can't publish this book about World War II because it has guns in it. But then the ridiculousness is that, you know, the person probably lives in a state where you can go to Walmart and buy a gun.
Right.
And we're just talking about history. We're trying to retell history in a simplified way. So there was some frustrations there, but that's not me picking on Scholastic. I mean, I could tell you things well before those years, art direction that just went sideways, you know,
right.
like once having to do a big charity poster featuring animals in a parade to raise money for one of the bigger charities. I did a lot of charity stuff in those days. And then, you know, I draw this scene where there's animals marching in a parade and there's a bird carrying the banner in the overhead, and the feedback that I got back, 15 people in a meeting that I wasn't invited to all decided that I had to change the artwork because, you know, you can't have a birds flying with a banner in their beaks because that wouldn't make any sense. But the idea is the animals are all in a parade and they're walking on two legs like people. So it was just this completely conflicted art direction, which is essentially the story of every illustrator who's ever tried to do this for a living. You're never really invited to the creative briefs.
Right.
You're just given the feedback after the fact.
I understand some of your artist friends had a little bit of fun with some of those renderings in those children's books.
Yeah, well, when the Viking book especially came out, there was some funniness there. You can see them on eBay, but yeah, there was a fella who had to Photoshop out all the shields and swords and axes and weapons out of the book, and they printed them, and the cover originally was this full-page splash of these Vikings running at you with swords, and there's no blood or anything. They're just running at you with swords and scary faces. And all the swords were removed, and so my friends got that hold of that cover, and they replaced what would have been swords with things like ice cream cones and various rubber massage items,
and
things of that nature.
Wow.
So yeah,
do you have those original pages that you drew?
I have all the original pages of everything I've done because no one's ever had to see them or wanted to see them. And to be honest with you, they're not all great.
I mean, there was something now to know that they've been edited the way they were, right?
Well, maybe it would. I don't know.
The
I don't know.
Original
that,
Mike Reed.
I don't know that they're worth book. Anything to begin with. To be honest with you, but
less ice cream cones.
But I've actually thought about bringing that old artwork out. People might be interested in seeing it. I mean, I kind of cut my teeth doing comics, working for them. I did, like I said, I was producing 45 or so pages every 6 weeks in full color. And I mean, back then I didn't know, like I was doing a lot of it with a mouse. Like I was coloring with a mouse.
Jeez.
Because I didn't know, and I didn't know that there was an option. I'm very much behind the times when it comes to technology and digital art and stuff. I'd love to try out one of these, one of these Cintiq, tablet tile things where you draw right on the screen. Like I've only ever drawn the blind style where you're working on your lap and looking at the screen. You know, and you have to kind of coordinate your hands and your hand and eye, which is actually really good, another set of muscles to develop, but not the ideal way to draw.
So, back to the con scene. One of the regulars that I see at a lot of the cons, Andrew Thomas, with his book Arlek of the Great Right North.
Yes.
I believe this was your creation or co-creation?
Yeah, there was a show, a great show, and if anyone listening wants to go to it, they should. It's in Timmins. It's the same weekend, I believe, as Ottawa Comic Con. I could be wrong, but it's coming up in May, the Northern Ontario Expo. And for their first show, they had me do they wanted me to do a poster, which is kind of how I got some of my early work in comics anyway, was doing posters for Comic Cons, just by volunteering, basically. And so I was doing that, and they wanted me to do one. And the coordinator of the show, one of the main guys I was working with, Jason Dennis, he had this idea that he wanted. He's a big Green Arrow guy, mm-hmm. and he wanted a Green Arrow kind of like a guy, you know, a character with a bow or something like that. So I just left it up to me. Now the event is held at a Lions Club. And so I decided to just make this kind of lion-headed kind of Conan character with a big great bow and a sword on his hip and just have some fun, do like a little Conan trope kind of thing. And they loved it. And then they had like a little naming contest, like name the character, and a couple people chimed in. And one lady, Kitty Motigny, I believe is her name. I'm probably not saying that right. But she supplied the name Oryk, and it got voted on, and that was the name. So... from there, they decided Davis Dewsbury, who's an awesome brain for comics and just an awesome dude. One of the best people you can know out there in the comic world if you're a freelancer or you're into comics. He's got so much passion. But anyway, he's a great writer too, very funny guy. And he took the character, and him and Andrew decided they wanted to do something fun with it. So I gave them my blessing, absolutely, and said, have some fun. And they've actually produced, what, 3 or 4 comics now, which is pretty amazing. Yeah, yeah. I've done a couple of cover pieces for them and stuff, and it's I love the character. I mean, I think I draw mine a little bit more serious than Andrew's. I mean, it is a more of a comedic book, I think, than a classic superhero kind of book. But I know that Davis and I have some ideas for a collaboration in the future, maybe doing kind of a more serious take on the character. I just have a one-shot story in my head that I'd like to do with Auric, which would feel very much like a Weapon X in Northern Canada, lost in the woods kind of story. I love the character. He's great fun to draw, so I wish them well, and I'm glad they're... I feel like it's in very good hands with those guys.
So I'll definitely like to read that one. People can't see my face, but I have a big smile on it because you said Weapon X and said Northern Canada and Auric.
Yeah.
I have a question in regards to characters, since you brought it up earlier about your favorite character, The Thing, and then you mentioned Conan. So what was it about The Thing, or any of the characters you like Conan, that appealed to you? What was it that made them your go-to characters?
Well, you know, I've kind of become more of a Conan guy as an adult, as a teenager and adult. When I was a kid, it was all about The Thing, and I, for the longest time, I thought I had imagined this cartoon appearance of The Thing and Fred Flintstone. There was this cartoon years ago. It was like The Thing meets Fred and Barney, or Fred and Barney meet The Thing, or something like that. And I watched it, and it blew my mind, and it was this kid, this red-haired kid, you know, Ben Grimm, skinny, nerdy kid with two rings. He punches the rings together and says, "Thing, ring, do your things," and transforms into The Thing, which is incredible. And The Thing had his own personality and his own voice and his own whatever, and I guess he just went away when the kid needed to be Ben Grimm again. But it was totally weird, and I don't think I had even read any Fantastic Four comics because I was too young to read back then. But I thought I had imagined it, because years and years went by, and as I became a bigger and bigger comic book fan, I loved The Thing. I gravitated towards buying Thing comics all the time. I actually would tell people about that Fred Flintstone cartoon, and people thought I was crazy. Like, pretty much anyone under 40 won't remember that show at all. And I just remembered a few scant TV appearances when I was a kid, but there was a show, there was like 8 or 12 episodes or something, and they weren't very long. They were like 8 minutes long or something. I recently got a disc of them, some of them burned on, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
The Thing, I think the attraction, I don't know, he... you know, he had blue eyes like me, I guess, and he was kind of a loner like I was, and he kind of was trapped in a body he didn't like I was, and there was a lot of things that still ring true today about The Thing, actually. I haven't read Marvel in a long time, since they killed off the Fantastic Four or ended them in that universe. That's a whole other podcast discussion, but I don't read a lot of Marvel comics in any way, because to me, a Marvel universe without the Hulk and without the Fantastic Four, it just doesn't make sense to me. And so I couldn't get into the Secret Wars and all this other recent stuff, but I do have my great memories of loving the Marvel universe, and The Thing kind of felt like my go-to guy. If Marvel wanted to give somebody a bad day in the Marvel universe, it was either Spider-Man, like Peter Parker specifically, or it was Ben Grimm. And, I mean, the only time Ben was even truly happy in his life was when he was on the fictional Secret Wars planet, when he was able to transform at will back and forth. He had a hot girlfriend, he could ride horses, he could do normal people things. And then when that world all fell apart because it was all fiction by the Beyonder, when he returned to Earth, he comes running home with roses for his girlfriend Alicia. He knocks on the door, and Johnny Storm answers the door wearing a towel.
Yeah.
And I remember it ripped my heart out. It destroyed me. And I felt at that point like a real true connection, because, you know, I think I might have been in grade 4 or 5 when that happened. And, you know, I remember having a crush on a girl at E.I. McCulley where I went to school. And you know what I mean? And it was never reciprocated, you know. And it's that kind of stuff that the thing just felt it all the time. And I think I was feeling it all the time. I'm a pretty high-strung guy most of the time. I worry about an awful lot of things. And I think that's where The Thing and I are similar. Only, you know, he can throw a tank into outer space and I can't. So... he can address his rage in different ways. So
you could do that on the page.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, but that's my attraction to the thing. I think the solitude of the character is what I like, and I think that's true with Conan too. I think there's just something about for Conan, for me, I think it just those John Buscema, Ernie Chan drawings from the Savage Sword, the black and white comic magazine. I think they just, I had so many of them, and they seemed like I wasn't supposed to be reading them. They seemed like they were too old for me, but I knew that, like, if my dad knew what was inside, like, not that there was ever any nudity or anything like that, but it pushed the limits that a 10-year-old mind could stretch, you know what I mean? Those early Frank Thorne Red Sonjas and stuff, like, that's just crazy stuff, man. Like, so good. So that stuff definitely had an effect. But I mean, reading comics growing up, it was always, you know, it was always the thing. Just for my dose of, it was Fantastic Four. Just for my dose of the thing when the Thing series ended, I loved that Thing solo series where he was a pro wrestler and stuff. Oh my God! Like, don't even get me started, or get me started. I don't care. I could talk about the Thing all day.
It's like they wrote it for you.
Yeah, it really felt Byrne. Like that, man. It really felt like that, and the John Byrne stuff, and Ron Wilson, just an unbelievable kind of underappreciated talent, I think. Just a tremendous, tremendous guy. I'd still love to get a commission from him. I actually found a page of his on eBay a couple years ago, and it was for a WCW comic, which was a page of Cactus Jack versus Ron Simmons, drawn by Ron Wilson. And it was, I think it was something absurd, like $50. And I was like, oh, my God, it's a dream. And I didn't have any money. I had no credit on my card. I couldn't get it. And then it was gone. I couldn't believe it, though. Yeah. I'd love to meet Ron Wilson one day, though, man. I think he's fantastic. And no one can draw the Thing like him. Even when he was just helping out or working with John Byrne, just the stuff he came up with on his own was incredible, too.
So years later, you get a pinup in Savage Sword.
Yeah, that was a huge dream. That was a big deal for me, and that was a totally random. I just happened to randomly meet someone at my table at Toronto Fan Expo when Dark Horse was here. I think that was going back 4 or 5 years now, but they were here, and again, I just had a couple of Conan prints on my table that I had on display, and had a Buffy the Vampire Slayer and some different things, and I got chatting with a guy about Dark Horse Comics, and little did I know he was actually an editor at Conan.
Wow.
And we were just having this candid, frank talk about, it was just natural, like I was just being passionate and talking about Conan, and he's like, so what do you want to do with your career? What do you want to do? And I just said, honestly, I said, my dreams are really small. I just want to get a pinup in Savage Sword of Conan. And he just started laughing, and he had his badge on, but his badge was turned away. I couldn't see his name. He flipped it around and showed me his name, and I was like, oh, my God.
Then you wish, I want to be the artist for Conan.
And he just laughed and said, I can hook you up with that. Wow. I can make that happen for you. He said, give me a call when I get back from Toronto. I'm having too much fun down here to do any work. And he was just a super nice guy, and I'm always grateful because, yeah, it just made me realize that sometimes you need to dream a little bit bigger because you might be surprised how quickly things come around for you. I mean, I just got comics in the mail yesterday of artwork that I completed a week before. And it's just the most surreal thing to, like, open up the mailbox and just be like, oh, I got my comps, and open, and like, I just drew this. How is it already a comic book and in my hands? Like, pretty incredible.
Turnover so fast.
So, I did one for Aftershock Comics, Pestilence, which came back, and it's just like, man, I couldn't believe it. It came out exactly as I thought it would, and it was just, I'll never take for granted how awesome it feels to get your own work in the mail. It's just, or to go into a comic shop and see your own work on the shelf. Like, it just, you know, it's crazy.
It's gonna be a great
believe show. In yourself. Believe in yourself, please. If you dream about this or you want to do this, it took me until I was in my 40s for any of this stuff to happen, but you know, you eventually hammer on a door so long that if they don't answer the door, the hinges will eventually come off and a crack of light comes through and maybe they can see what you can do. And sometimes it's a lucky encounter. Sometimes it's someone you meet. Sometimes it's just a chance happening at a Comic-Con. But,
but you have to be ready.
You have to be ready, and your work has to have presented those. I mean, I do believe in luck, but I don't throw a lot of power behind luck because I think you make your own luck in this world. And I think you have to work really hard to get into a position where those lucky opportunities can even happen, you know?
So you mentioned a little bit about your charity work earlier. There was a special project that came out a few years ago, the Sekai Project, where a few artists got together. I believe his wife was sick, or it was we're a charity that way, and a lot of artists got together to put this book, and I guess the proceeds went towards him and his family.
Yeah.
And you were a part of that. So
yeah, no, that was I mean, I'm not even sure how that happened. I can't quite remember. I did remember getting an email, I think, asking if I wanted to be a part of it. I've always been a huge Usagi Yojimbo fan, and Stan Sakai is one of the nicest people in the world. And he's just one of those guys that's been there longer than you think he has. He was you know, lettering comics that you read and you had no idea. I can promise you that. But no, I've always loved the character, and one of those indie giants to me. And yeah, his wife, I believe, was very sick, or was seeing her last days in the hospital anyway. And yeah, the project went towards that. And I couldn't believe I got in. Like I, you know, and then the piece ended up selling very high on eBay. I was shocked. I mean, I didn't have any kind of name or status attached to me. I'd gotten a pinup in a Conan book, which is a big deal to me, but in the grand scheme of the comics world, it's not really a huge... A pinup won't even typically get you a credit on a book, but I just did it for the pure love. So the fact that I was able to get on this Stan Sakai, which is also a Dark Horse thing, it was... Yep. That was wonderful, and there was just some incredible art in that book. So I felt very, very lucky to be among those guys.
And I highly recommend, if you could still buy it. It's a gorgeous book.
Oh, it's just a beautiful book. Yeah, just a beautiful book. Absolutely.
So speaking of, you said you got into the comic book industry a little bit later. How would you, if somebody wanted to get into the industry, if they had that passion the way you had it? Nobody's story is the same, right? There's not one route to take. So what advice would you give to somebody who wants to pursue that?
Well, honestly, it's kind of hard to say. Like when I finished school, I was so scared to get into the idea to be a full-time illustrator, because I had a student loan to pay back, and I was terrified. I'd only really done factory work and grunt labor and you know, digging and shovel work for a while. So the idea of going out and pounding the streets and looking for jobs as an illustrator was really tough. So I actually, when I finished school, I got a job in construction. And I had an epiphany moment on the job site, where I was carrying a huge steel plank with another man off of a truck down a slippery path into a convention center where a huge curling tournament was happening. And he was on the other end of this massive plank, and he stumbled and kind of twisted his grip, and I lost my footing and slipped and went down hard on the ice. And I got my hands out of the way as this massive plank came down, which would have smashed both of my hands into strawberry jam.
Wow.
And the sound of that plank hitting the ground and me staring there at my hands, which had been unhurt, it was like this bell that went off in my core of my bones. When I could feel it in my bones, I vibrated that whole day from the shake of that fall. And I beelined right to my foreman, and I just took off my hat and I said, "I'm done. I'm going home." And he's like, "Are you hurt? What's going on?" I said, "No, I'm done. This is my last day with you. And thank you for the opportunity, but I'm no good to you right now." And I left, and I called my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, and I just said, "Erica, what's up? You know, I said, can you come and get me? I said, I'm heading home." And she's like, "What do you mean? You're done for the day?" I said, "No, I'm done. I'm just done." I said, she's like, "Well, what are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to be an illustrator, or I'm going to starve to death." And that's it.
Wow.
So I immediately started going after jobs, whatever jobs I could get. If it was an opportunity to be published, whether it paid $10 or $1,000 or 50 cents or paid nothing, I would do the job just for the sake of getting out there and building a portfolio. I treated every single piece I did, regardless of who the client was, whether it was a portrait of someone's recently departed pet, if it was a portrait, if it was a tattoo design, if it was a logo design, if it was someone wanted a mural in their basement, if someone wanted a picture of a palm tree on the side of their garage, whatever it was, all of these things are things I've actually done. And they're you know, I would work for a case of beer, I would work for a sandwich, and then things began to pick up and I started getting real work. And the work I did for charity actually gave me a great baseline of working for a bunch of different people, because I was doing stuff for the Canadian Lung Association, cancer, heart and stroke, Easter Seals, lots of different people. And they would need artwork for their pitch envelopes to try to get donors to submit money and you know, get on the trolley with raising money for these different causes. And so I was doing artwork, and the money was actually quite good for what it was. Very quick turnaround, and not always the best artwork. art direction, but I'll always be grateful for those years because I was working in all these different corners of the illustration world. I was doing children's books. I was doing charity stuff. I was doing heavy metal tattoos. I was doing all different kinds of things. So it got to a point where my portfolio was diverse enough that I could work for anybody. And one day I've been doing the children's books for years, and one day I got the phone call that the job was over and that I literally had 2 days left of paid income, and then that was it due to a restructuring at the company. So it was a big shock because working freelance in this country on your own means you don't have access to EI, you don't have access to a lot of different things which are available to people who have a so-called real job. So there I found myself at age 35, penniless and basically feeling like a failure, and I said, screw this, man. If I'm going to be starting my career over at zero, because in the time that I worked for Scholastic and Rubicon, I had to basically cut off all my other clients. There was no time to serve them. And the minute you say no to that regular client, they go and find someone else, and they become that person becomes their go-to. So I lost 10 years of building a Rolodex of people for the sake of having full-time work. So when that ran out, I had nothing, and I had to start my career over again, and I said, screw it, man. And I just went to the local comic shop here in Oakville, Comic Connection, and I would hang out there all day, and I would do sketches for people if they wanted sketches. I would do sketches for the shop. I would do little posters or graphic design bits for the shop. They gave me, you know, I would trade sandwiches for, I would trade drawings for my lunch. I would trade Morrow's French fries for a sketch cover. And then once in a while, I would just sit and do sketch covers all day, and Rich, the shop owner, would put them up on eBay, and they'd begin to sell. And then I started getting some attention.
Right.
And then it kind of went from there. So to answer your question of how to get started, I really don't know, because I took a very roundabout route to get here. But I would say the classic advice that my friends who are indie guys like Ben Templesmith and some of these guys that I really look up to in the comics, they always say the same thing. If you want to break into comics, you have to make comics. And Ben is constantly on my ass, in a good way, about getting my comic out, working on my projects, and really, really pushing forward and saying, you know, hey, you know, you got to make this comic happen. It's great to get professional work, but you got to make your own voice heard. You got to get your own comic out. And he's absolutely right. So I would say if you're a young comic book artist out there, or an old comic book artist out there who wants to do something in this business, just start doing things you want to do. Make your own comics. It's going to cost you money. It's going to cost you time and tears and blood and sweat. And you may gain weight sitting down putting all those hours on the table like I have, but... You know, take care of yourself and make your comics and get out there and get seen.
So
certainly social media is huge. Instagram is huge. Facebook is huge. I don't know that there's a lot of value of having your own art page on Facebook, but I don't have one myself. But there's lots of different tools out there. We live in a fantastic age for self-promotion, and that's the way to go, I think, really. The idea of getting a job, so like I hear young people come to my table, oh, well, I figure I'll get a job at Marvel or DC, and if that doesn't work, I'll get a job at Image. And that's just a completely absurd thing to say. I'd love that too.
Right.
You know, but, you know, it's not for lack of trying.
Right.
It's just the way it is. It's a very tough industry. Very tough.
Absolutely. So speaking of your own comic,
yes.
A very personal project, Widow's Wake.
Yeah.
We've gotten tastes here and there. There's a sketchbook that was released a while back, has a very distinct page layout in it. Can you sort of tell us a couple of questions? Can you sort of tell us what we will be expecting when this is released? And how is that process going with you right now?
Well, Widow's Wake is something that I've been super excited about for a long time. But the reality in this business is, you know, someone's got to keep the lights on while you make your comics. And I've been fortunate enough to get some professional work, to get some covers through different companies, Chapter House for Captain Canuck, and Aftershock Comics has been a tremendous place. You know, getting paid in American dollars doesn't hurt either, but the work has been amazing. Really, really behind everything I'm doing for them. And sorry, I'm kind of going off on a tangent there.
Sorry.
We like it.
Get back on track. So, what was the...
Widow's
Wake, right. So Widow's Wake has been sitting on the shelf much longer than it should have. And unfortunately, sometimes when the things sit on the shelf too long, the spark can get very dim and hard to see. And I will go through periods of real, genuine excitement, and I'll knock out two pages, and then something will kind of sidetrack me, and I'll end up spending, you know, 2 or 3 months not even thinking about the project or moving it forward. It really started out, the difficulty with Widow's Wake is it was just a short story initially, and I've never released my own comic before, so I put a lot of pressure on myself for that first year. And I did a lot of work that was actually not going to be even appearing in the first issue, just to develop the world around the first issue, because the first issue really could be told in about 5 pages. You know, a short story about 4 dead Vikings on a beach really is what it is. But it's... because I was developing this world and I felt like I had a bigger story to tell, other stories began to formulate out of this little story. And the little story was then going to be a preamble to a much bigger story. But then I thought, nah, let's just go back and make it a one-shot and see if anyone actually gives a shit about the story, because I do, and it's a different Viking thing, and Vikings are kind of popular, and this is going back now a few years before the Viking show was even on the air, right. So it's kind of one of these, like... You know, all this Viking stuff started popping up all around me, which was beautiful. It's wonderful. 10-year-old Mike inside is, like, freaking out because, I mean, I've been a Viking freak since I was a kid, you know. But I think I've put a lot of pressure on myself about it. And now, unfortunately, the book feels like it is a tremendous point of shame instead of something that I'm prideful about, because I've seen guys like, you know, like Shane Herron and Ricky Lima and, you know, Ben Templesmith and, you know, Shay Han and all these amazing dudes in the Toronto area and just other guys around the world that I admire. Like, in the time that I've been trying to cut one nine-page or 10-page story, which blew up to a 25-page story and then turned into a 48-page story and then got reduced back down to a 20-page story. Like, I can't decide what I want to do. I've drawn whole pages that have been redrawn, even though I haven't gotten to the final story. But these guys that I mentioned, like, they're producing comics regularly. Like, you know, they're producing comics every month or every 2 months, and they inspire the hell out of me. Ben in particular is a really self-driven dude, and he's produced so much stuff since I started this little idea that it's almost like he's lapping me, and every time he laps me, he gives me a high five and tells me to keep up, you know, and the encouragement's fantastic, but the getting the work done has been really hard. Now, that said, on the other side of things, when I'm getting professional work, I'm never late with it. I get it done on time, mm-hmm. because there's a different drive behind it. I think I'm a bit of a perfectionist by nature, so given an unlimited toolbox and an unlimited amount of time to do a project, I will still take it right to the finish line. There's no real pressure. Now, my wife's very deadline-driven, and she's right. Like, well, how about I just give you a deadline and say it has to be done at the end of this month, and that's it. And that's cool, but then, you know, real life gets in the way, and suddenly you need to put new tires on the car, or there's a, you know, whatever, there's some other big expense comes along, and I just don't live in a world where I'm, you know... I just don't have the extra cash to be able to just devote an entire weeks on my comic, but I'm hoping the time will come. I thought about a Patreon, I thought about Kickstarters and things like that to give me motivation, but my feeling on Kickstarter is that I've been burned enough time supporting other people's Kickstarters that I feel like I want to have the book 99% done before I even go down that road, so that really the funding is just to ensure that it's able to get printed and maybe do a couple of special bonuses that go with the book, but I won't even go down that road. I won't even do a video for a Kickstarter until the book is 99% done, because I just don't want to be on the hook. The other problem is I work full-time as a superintendent of my building, which, while lately, knock on wood, has been a very quiet job, there's times when it's not. And right when things were getting super hot with the Widow's Wake 2 winters ago, which sounds ridiculous to even say out loud, but there was a point in time when I was really pushing for a Heroes Con release in June, so I was grinding all winter. I had a massive plumbing disaster at my building, which took 6 weeks of my life away. I wasn't in the studio one day in those 6 weeks, and it was a nightmare. So I wasn't getting anything done for Widow's Wake. I wasn't getting any commissions done. It just was a major setback. And luckily, things have been quiet in that realm, and I've been able to get my other deadlines taken care of, but... Right now, unfortunately, Widow's Wake is sitting on the shelf. But when the book does come, it's going to be hopefully something a little bit different. It's a Viking horror story. It's very dear to my heart, as all Viking stuff is. But man, there's just so much good Viking stuff coming out now. I feel like every time I think, I'm going to post this page, and then I go, but this guy just posted from his Viking book, and it's way cooler than what I'm doing.
I was just about to say, I think the world is ready for this.
Oh, I think so.
We're seeing that resurgence, and you know, the Viking show again, like you mentioned, is very popular. I think that, and a lot of these, you know, these shows that when we were growing up, at least at our age, we never saw anything like this that we're seeing these days.
Lucky. I hate being that guy that hates the different Marvel stuff that's on TV or elements of it, because I'm like, who the hell are you to complain about this stuff, man? You would have killed for this stuff as a kid. I would have murdered somebody for a TV show about Daredevil or Iron Fist, especially. I haven't even watched Iron Fist yet. I just don't think I can. Yeah. I can't go there. And Luke Cage, my God, I swear to God, when I was a kid, I was the only person I knew that was reading Power Man and Iron Fist comics. All my friends had X-Men comics.
Right.
And they all had allowances. I never had an allowance growing up, so they were buying their comics new, and I was buying 25-cent bin comics. But I was coming home with armloads of Power Man and Iron Fist.
The cool stuff before we all knew it was cool.
Like, I remember buying a comic that had Sabretooth and Constrictor in it, beating the crap out of Power Man and Iron Fist. I mean, that's just amazing to me. Like, I love that stuff, man.
Fantastic.
Can't have those days back, unfortunately, but they were great days to be alive in.
So you mentioned your as part of Widow's Wake is actually co-created by your wife Erica.
Yeah.
So how was that relationship? Like, how are you? How was that working on a project? Were you actually talking about potentially other projects as well, working with Erica?
Oh yeah. No, we've had a couple of ideas throwing around, and we like I said, when we were developing Widow's Wake, we came up with a kind of a bigger story that she really wants to tell, and we have this whole idea of these this whole line of Valkyries. These widows, essentially, in the comic that ascend to a different level. And we had all these great stories written about them, because at its core, Widow's Wake is actually a love story. It's about what really gets left behind on the battlefield. And I think sometimes the widows of fallen warriors have even more interesting stories to tell than the men that died on the end of a spear. And what's left behind is kind of what we wanted to explore with the story a little bit. But the development with Widow's Wake was cool with Erica, because she's also a silversmith, and she was making jewelry that actually is appearing in the book. So the idea was to have a line of things that were handmade, unique items, so that the real big fans of the book, if they wanted to have the actual brooch that, you know, that Ephira's wearing, or the actual Thor pendant that Arn is wearing, or the different characters in the book, like, that's what we wanted to have available. Erica only makes one of a kind thing, so it make for a very short list. Awesome. But the idea was that we would have that and develop some other prints and things like that, a calendar, like a Valkyrie's calendar, some different things around our book, because it's just Viking stuff, and there's no ownership or copyright to be concerned about. It's public domain, you know, it's old legends, right? So that's what kind of makes it special. But working with Erica has been awesome on the book, because she's, like, I can sit and tell you guys a story and what it's all about, but the sitting down, the structure of writing is where I kind of fall apart. And I've had lots of people offer to, like, proofread and edit and do different things, and I'm grateful for it all. But I feel like the story went off the rails, because it was really just a short story that turned into a big story that I try to turn back into a short story. And I have all this knowledge about what I want to do, but the viewers don't have that knowledge when they're reading the book. And I feel like it's making elements of the story a bit harder to tell. And I want to get back to the core idea, which I feel like got lost during the process of this world building, which is interesting. It was an interesting experience, but I kind of feel like I don't want to be, known as a hack who talked about a comic book that never got made. I have to make the comic now to save my soul, if for no other reason. But I just don't know when that's going to happen. So I'm going to have to wander the soulless limbo of being a freelance creator right now until I can get those days and hours stacked up to make the work happen, you know?
I think there's two different types of creative people. There's people who work well if they just have all the freedom in the world to do it, and they can do whatever they want and no one tells them. But then there's some of us who need to kind of be reined in and work with a certain parameter. Do you find that that's part of what's difficult? Do you find if you have a deadline, I know it needs to get done, I have no choice, and it gives you that inspiration?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. I mean, the cover that I did for C2E2 this weekend for World Reader, which is a Jeff Loveness and Juan Doe production from Aftershock,
I had 24 hours to turn that cover around, and and it's going down. It's probably my favorite cover I've actually done for them, or second favorite anyway.
Yeah.
The one I just did for Pestilence is my favorite, I think. But the one I did for World Ritter was special because I had no time to think about it. I just had to produce, get a sketch approved, and get the artwork done, and just make it happen. And I think when you limit your palette and you limit your time, wonderful things can happen. So yeah, looking back, I absolutely should have given myself a hard deadline and just crushed it out. But like I said, this perfectionist nature inside me is the greatest detriment to my career. I saw a video going around YouTube a little while ago that was called Finished But Not Perfect or something along those lines. And it really rung a bell with me because the whole message is just get it done. It's not going to be your defining work. It's not going to be the thing that changes your life. I mean, maybe it will be, but until it does, you won't know. So just get this thing done and then move on to the next thing, because there's other things you want to do. And I have other stories that are just beating down the doors that I would love to do, but Widow's Wake is sitting there kind of like this great, heavy, loaded weight blocking the door, and I really want to get that done. But in the meantime, honestly, if I'm completely honest, as much as I would love to do my own thing, all I've wanted to do is like regular work for a good company, and right now I have that, and it feels like a tremendous blessing. So that's kind of what I'm focusing on. If I have to trade doing my own stuff and going on tour and doing a lot of Comic-Cons for the sake of hitting professional deadlines, it's a very, very easy trade for me to make. It's what I've always been working towards. So if it means it delays my own projects, that's fine. If I'm able to feed my cats and take care of some bills and feel like I'm living like a normal person instead of a desperate, hungry person all the time, then I can get behind that lifestyle for a while if it means a sacrifice of my own creative ends. Right. But it's going to happen. It is going to happen. I want to tell the story, certainly before this Viking wave is over, before it washes away like the sandcastle on the beach. Right now is a great time to be a Viking fan or a Viking file or whatever you want to call it.
So. And it'll never be like when you're a perfectionist, it'll never be perfect to you, but to the fans that are waiting for it, they won't know the difference. It'll be perfect to them. Right?
No, it's true. I mean, to a degree, I'm sure I feel like I feel like it shows when I'm tired sometimes. I hope it doesn't show when the people who are looking at my work, but it's a challenging way to work. It's a challenging business, and you want to represent yourself with the best of your abilities, but at the same time, you don't always have the luxury of time. I did a cover for Conan and Red Sonja 2 summers ago, which was a mind-blowing phone call to get. I'll never forget that day when I got asked to do this cover for them, because it was two characters that used to be part of the same universe when I was a kid, but now are owned by two different comic book companies. Right. So the fact that they were together in one book was kind of awesome. By the time I actually got to work on it, I had 36 hours to turn that project around. And they wanted an Earl Norum kind of classic savage sort of Conan cover vibe, that fully painted cover vibe. And the really weird thing was that weekend, I had to channel Earl Norum super hard because I only had 24 hours at this point. I had the sketch approved and I had to turn around this painting with all these characters in it, and I did it and it nearly killed me. But then Earl Norum passed away that same weekend, and it freaked me out. I was, because I hadn't slept in 2 days, I was hallucinating at that point, and I read the news that Earl Norum had passed away, and he was a tremendous person, tremendous god in my art development. Huge. Well, he did all the He-Man packaging. You remember his work mostly from Conan, but he also did all the packaging and poster art for all the Masters of the Universe stuff, which is incredible.
Yeah,
that's all I wanted to do, that kind of stuff when I was a kid, right? So the fact that he passed away the same weekend I was trying to ape his style was just something I always stuck with me, kind of weird. But anyway, Earl was great, and I hope he rests in peace. He was a fantastic artist.
I mean, that was a fantastic cover.
Thank you.
One of my favorites of yours. And speaking about some of your cover art, so you've been doing a lot lately, but you've gone back a little bit. Captain Canuck is one of the ones that you've done as well. What was it like working for that character or with that character?
Oh, I love the character. I've always, I always love the design. I mean, deep down, I think I'm actually an Alpha Flight guy. So I'd have people bring me Alpha Flight comics and have me sign. Can you sign this? And I'm like, no, I actually never drew Alpha Flight. I worked on Captain Canuck though, and he looks kind of like Guardian, but Guardian.
That's right.
Guardian. I've always felt like I'm a giant John Byrne guy, so to me, Guardian, I mean, there's guys who will hate hearing this, but to me, Guardian is just a better design Captain Canuck, sorry, Richard Cumley, I love you, but I'm just saying there's something about the classic look of that Guardian costume is just so great. But he's essentially Canada's super soldier type character. I love the old Captain Canuck comics. I love the new ones, too. Working with that character was awesome because I got to work on him during his 40th anniversary year with Chapter House, or just his 40th year since he was created, and that was the year that I turned 40 as well, so it was kind of a fun thing. And I was able to get some covers through Carlos Camara at Gotham Central, who's a great friend to the Toronto comic book scene and one of the best guys you can know in comics if you're from here and you want to make comics. He's an excellent guy. He hosts great events, and he had this A variant program, and he had me doing some covers, which actually landed me a couple of Image covers, which was fantastic. Like for Nailbiter, which is one of my favorite series, which is over now, just ended recently, and also Wicked and Divine, and also Ray Fox's comic Intersect. So those were tremendous opportunities. But the Captain Canuck stuff I loved because it was real superhero stuff, and the other stuff was more kind of like crime or horror based, which I love drawing too. But getting a chance to draw like a real superhero like Captain Canuck was a pretty big deal.
Awesome.
Love the character. So yeah, I had some fun with those covers.
What's your process like when you, because you're pretty well known for your comic book cover stuff. So when you are given an assignment like Animosity, Captain Canuck, or something like that, what information are you given going into that? How do you approach it? What's your turnover time? Give us an idea of how your work
is. Sure. Well, usually what I'll get, if I'm lucky enough to have a script of the first issue or whatever issue the artwork is going to be appearing on, that's a huge bonus. When it's a new property, it makes it exciting because it doesn't mean I get to add something that wasn't thought of before, but it means I do get to kind of put my own slant or my own feeling on a character that hasn't been around long enough for anyone to get a really hardened feeling about.
Mm-hmm.
When you're given something like while it's many people's dream to draw Batman or Conan, the pressure of drawing a character with such a long life, long publishing history is tremendous. I mean, I know lots of guys who finally were given that opportunity and later told me that it was a nightmare because they had so much pre-existing fan pressure about how a character should be or look or whatever. Right. So in the case of Aftershock, it's been great because it's all been brand new, creator-owned material with great characters. So I've really been into everything I've had to draw because the characters are just super fun. In the case of Animosity, it's always animals. So I can do some interesting stuff with animals, making use of their natural abilities, thrown in a more human dialogue. My process would be generally to read it and come up with an idea and then flesh out that idea with a bunch of little sketches. And then once I'm sort of happy with most of my work is figure driven. So once I get I'm happy with an interchange of characters or the way a character fills out the composition on the page, I start working in that direction and looking for ways I can improve that. So I might do 3 or 4 very, very rudimentary drafts of what I want to do before I start working on a more serious drawing. Where I maybe would even go as far as shooting some photo reference if it's a specific pose for a hand or a body shape or a particular lighting that I need or a particular scene. Google is also helpful for getting some groundwork on some of those, but it's always great if you can shoot your own reference for that kind of stuff. Put people that you know in comics and none the wiser. So I'll go through that process of getting that final drawing approved, and then I'll blow the drawing up to much larger than print size. For 2 reasons. One, it means that when the drawing's reduced back down to comic book size, it'll look much tighter and those fine details become even finer and more precise, which, you know, it can be impressive. And also, it gives me a great big painting to sell to a collector, for people who collect original art. And that's also how I patch together a livelihood by selling original art. So
do they tell you, do they give you any direction in terms of, I want to have these characters on the cover, or is this all your idea or your creative?
Well, I mean, earlier Eric had asked me... I just dropped my eraser. earlier Eric had asked me about... sorry, I just got sidetracked there. About the process. I just lost my train of thought. That happens a lot. I'm getting older. So sometimes I'll be given very specific feedback to work from, and sometimes I'm given nothing at all. Okay. And I actually kind of prefer when I'm given very specific feedback, because I spent so many years working as an art robot for Scholastic Books and for Rubicon and people like that, where, I mean, I would get a layout for a book and I wouldn't even have to think about how the comic book was gonna look. The pages would already be laid out in terms of the panel sizes or how many panels per page. And literally, I would be given a PDF of a 44-page script, and the pages would all be laid out pre-hand, like with all boxes drawn in Illustrator or Photoshop or whatever, and inside each box would be a little pink descriptor of text of what they wanted in each box. And so I was literally filling in the boxes. And it got to the point where I was producing so much work for them that I would get a comp copy 3 months later in the mail and open it up and actually have no memory of drawing that book. And it was a super surreal thing, because I'd even color the work too. I spent a lot of time with those pages, and I'd get them back, and I'd be maybe be 6 months or a year later, and I'd be like, "What the hell? I don't even remember drawing any of this." So nowadays, when I'm getting a cover, I usually ask for what goes on in the issue. I usually, if I can, I love working directly with the original creator. Very often I get paired with an editor or something like that, but there's been occasions, like recently with Aftershock issue 4, I had no idea what was happening in issue 4, and I asked the creator, Marguerite Bennett, who's a lovely, lovely person. I asked her via email what she'd like to see on the cover. And she kind of gave me a brief idea, and I actually, to the letter of what she asked for, I drew it. And when I sent it off, she was like, "Oh my God, it's exactly what I asked for." And I was like, "See, that's kind of what I do." Like, so I love working directly with the creator when I can. I had the opportunity to work with Kieran Gillen for Wicked and Divine when I did a variant for them. And it was amazing just to email him and be like, and it was a little bit of a problem because he's in the UK, so there was a time delay kind of thing. I'd send him something on a Monday night, and I'd need feedback by Monday night, and it's actually Tuesday morning for him.
Right.
So like things would go kind of weird there, but yeah, he eventually just kind of art directed me. I gave him an idea. He loved the idea. I sent him a sketch. He said, "Go with that one." I colored it. He said, "Let's go with the black and white." Like, he was very honest and kind, and it was great. So any opportunity to work directly with the creator, I absolutely love that. But so often I'm just given a script and, you know, just come up with something cool. So yeah, that's I kind of prefer art direction, but I can wing it if I have to.
You definitely came up with some things that were cool.
Yeah. Well, I gave him no art direction when I asked you for that Bret Hart commission.
Oh, right. Yeah,
I think fun. He was like, "Well, you got to tell me what you..." I didn't realize that the art direction would have helped, but man, I loved what you came up with.
Well, you know, I just recently did one for Pestilence, which is a cool story, like a medieval kind of zombie story. And the guy who, you know, I'm doing the cover for, he sent me art direction, but it was like pretty intense. It was like a lot to fit into a single cover, which was actually kind of cool, because my editor, Stefan Nilsson, who was working in between, he was basically like, "Well, you know, this would actually look good on two covers." And so it became a double cover job that actually connects. So it actually worked out good. I always want to be the guy who can make the customer, the end user, happy. I mean, you know, people can buy my stuff if they want to, but the person who hired me for the job is most important. And they're the one, if they have something specific, a vision that they want to see, I always want to come as close to that vision as I can. That's the job of an illustrator. At least that's always been my job. And so when I'm given clear art direction, I love to take it to the letter and maybe throw a few surprises in there, but I love to work directly with the, you know, with the original visionary. It takes a team to make these things happen, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I'm not sure if I answered that entirely.
No, you did.
You did.
Probably at extra length. So yeah.
One other thing that you worked on a little bit, Headlopper.
Yes.
So another one that.
Well, that was just a comic that I fell in love with. I met him at a show, Andrew McLean, a few years ago, and I just absolutely picked up the trade paperback off his table before it was an image book. And I went crazy. I went back to my table, and my wife actually read it first while I was working on a commission. It was at C2E2 or something like this many years ago. And my wife read it, and she was just laughing her guts out. And she's like, "You got to see this comic book." And she showed me this page, and it was this particular scene where he chops a monster's head off, and he gets spit out by the monster. And it's just this beautiful drawing. Made me think a little bit of Mike Mignola stuff, and I just got so into it. And then we actually had a chance to meet him, and he's just the nicest guy. His wife, Erin, is the nicest person. And so, yeah, that kind of... And then one day I just shot him an email. I'm like, "Oh, dude, you know, the Headlopper's coming up for Image. I'd love to do a pinup." And he was like, "Yeah, I love your stuff. Like, let's do it. So that's just kind of how it happened. So I always, I don't want to give anyone the wrong idea when people say, oh, you worked on Headlopper. I just did a pinup for
it.
Right. I've done a pinup for a lot of books. And so unfortunately, sometimes at a Comic-Con, it'll say like Mike Ruth artist, and it will list some of my credits, but it will list credits I've done pinups. And right. I had nothing to do with the creation of Nailbiter or The Walking Dead or any of these things I've done pinups for, because it's just, and I don't want to get the wrong idea across. A lot of guys will take small credits and they'll blow them out of proportion, like it's their greatest, it's the greatest thing, and you know, and I don't want to ever feel like I never take any of this for granted. So the fact that I'm even allowed to appear in some of these great creators' books is a tremendous blessing. I never ask for money for them, because I just love to be a part of them. You know, a lot of guys will pay and offer anyway, because they're, you know, they're happy with the work. But yeah, I just love that character. I could, a character like Headlopper, I could literally draw all day long. I would never get tired of it. I just love that kind of Conan stuff, you know, that sci-fi fan or that fantasy stuff. And his style is so amazing. Like, I've seen Andrew do commissions of other superheroes for people at shows, and he draws them in that same amazing style. And like, it's just, I think guys who have a strong, recognizable style really impress me, because people say that about my work, but I've never seen it in my own work. And I think artists spend a long time searching for a style, searching for a voice. And I feel like a lot of my stuff, I overdraw a lot of stuff. I maybe reference too closely, or I worry about how my work gets seen. But then sometimes I'll just draw something off the hip. Off, you know, right out of the holster, so to speak, and it comes out better than stuff that's really labored over or photo referenced. So, yeah, I think I'm always searching for a style that's distinctly my own. So when there's guys out there like Ben Temple Smith or Andrew McLean who have a really clear look, really distinctive look, I mean, those guys always blow my head apart.
I would argue that he definitely does.
I was just gonna say, like, I know if there's a variant cover, and it's a Mike Ruth variant cover.
Well, I appreciate that.
So you have a distinct style, and you're even just at the cons when you go to your table, you definitely know what's your work. Like it's signature, which is always a good thing.
Well, thanks. I mean, I do a couple tricks with ink and wash that I think help set some of that distinction aside, but. But I really appreciate hearing that. I know that the banner that you mentioned, the big weaponizer banner, that was a case of not having any art direction. A friend of mine, Bram, and some other fellows and ladies working that I knew through the Warren Ellis Whitechapel forum for the Freak Angels comic. I used to get my work up on that site for the remake remodels that Warren would do. And anyway, Bram started this. He's a rapper and a poet in Scotland, and he actually started this thing called Weaponizer, and he asked me to do the cover for the first issue, and I said, what would you like? And he's like, just draw whatever you want. And I knew that it was going to be a magazine with fiction and short stories and things like that, and I knew that he was a UK guy, and I really wanted to get that kind of space Viking kind of vibe, that mm-hmm. Warhammer 40K kind of feel. So that was a piece where I literally had the image in my head, and I sat down and I drew it exactly as it appeared in my head, and that never happens. And that was because I was given absolute freedom in it. I didn't panic over it too long. I had a deadline. I hit the deadline. And then I just loved the image so much. And I eventually sold the original. It was actually one of the only times I actually was... It was like saying goodbye to a friend, selling that painting. But I got exactly what I wanted for it. And a customer that asked me about it 3 years in a row, and he finally submitted to my price. I never changed my price. I never gave him a deal. And he eventually said, okay, I have to have it then. The price was $444. I don't know why. That was just the price I gave it. That was a big life-changing. So, perfect. Wayne, if Wayne's listening, that was a big deal for me, Wayne.
Sounds like it's in a good home.
But I think he wanted it because I wouldn't lament on the price. And I think that was part of it. There was a real respect born there. But anyway, that poster, though, I ended up leaving it in Seattle when I was there in Emerald City this year. So a guy in Seattle bought it off of me, the banner itself, and he hung it in his office. So it has a forever home in a guy's cubicle right now, which makes me happy. I do need a new banner, though, as a result. I got a shows coming up this spring that I got to have a new banner for. I have a cool kind of basic one, but I want to get something that's more colorful. I've actually thought about taking one of my Animosity covers and maybe doing a new banner with that, because some of them have been pretty popular. So we'll see. Yeah, awesome. See how it goes.
I have a question for you, Martin. I know this is the Mike Ruth.
Okay.
But I have a question for you, because I think about it. So if you had a job that you would love to see his artwork in? Wow. Whether it's a monthly book or something that you just feel like he would be perfect for. I know Conan is the one. What's yours? And Mike, how about you? I want you to give me a list of like your dream assignments. What do you think, Martin?
For me?
Conan. Absolutely.
Yeah. That's the natural one, right?
I believe that Mike was born to draw Conan, so...
It seemed like when I saw his stuff at his booth, I almost felt like, oh, he must be the Conan, like, regular artist. That's what it looked like to me. I'm not just saying that. Well, I meant it. Like,
it's funny that you say that, because I mean, Conan would definitely be a book that would be a dream to do. I don't know how I'd want to go about doing it, though. I think... one day Conan will become part of the public domain, and I think at that time there's going to be a lot of guys doing Conan stories based off the Robert E. Howard original stuff, the original text. Yep. Which, if you've not read them, they're fantastic, and they're dated, and they're of a certain era, so you got to get beyond a few liberties in his writing that you can't get away with nowadays. But they're wonderful for what they are, and I enjoy the hell out of them. And I'd love to do a take on Red Nails one day. I was listening to some Robert E. Howard audio recordings from, I'm going to call it LibriVox, on my old, crusty old Mac. And I was just doing sketches while I was listening to these stories. I was just drawing what kind of came to mind. I drew Valeria, and I drew some different characters from Red Nails. So I'd love to do some stuff like that. But yeah, Conan would be a huge one, or Red Sonja. But you know, it's funny that you say that, because last night I was kind of thinking about this interview today, and I knew that you're going to have your Conan book, and I was thinking about what I was going to draw. So I was just doing a shit ton of sketches of Conan last night, and I think I drew him about 25 times, and I only had 3 sketches out of the 25 that I even kind of liked. Because, again, he's a character that I love, and I put a lot of pressure on myself to draw him the right way, but I bet you... I mean, it's every time I draw Conan, he comes out a little bit differently. So getting on this is me admitting a weakness, but I think I'd want some time to really... I mean, that first issue of Conan, if I was ever given a Conan gig, would be a pretty telling issue as to how well I can handle the character.
Right.
It'd be a great test. I actually am developing a Conan story right now. I've got Fearless Fred. He's kind of helping me out with it a little bit, but I pitched him the idea and he thought it was good. I actually pitched the idea at a Comic-Con. Someone asked me at a Comic-Con at a panel if I could pair any two characters together and write a story and make a story out of it, what would it be? And I ended up just kind of throwing this pitch out, and everyone was just like, oh my God, you have to do that. And one of the other panelists was Tom Fowler, who's a great Canadian artist, one of my favorite painters. And he basically punched me and said, dude, you have to tell that story, because if you don't tell that story, I'm going to. Mm.
Need that pressure. Mike needs the pressure.
Yeah, and it was actually, I don't want to say what it is in case I do.
Okay.
But I will say it involves Conan, and it involves a character that also is in that... In the publishing world, in the same company, in the same universe. So it's a crossover that I have in mind. They don't do crossovers with Conan too often, but they do them with Red Sonja. So worst case scenario, if my story doesn't work with one, it might work with someone else. But it's something I'm really passionate about. I have a really basic, simple story. Again, I think the best stories are the simple ones.
Yeah.
And I have one that I think would really turn some heads, especially if you grew up in the 80s and you're a fan of the Conan movies and are a fan of Schwarzenegger movies in general. There would be some. There's a hint in there.
I'm not going to say it. But I'll talk about after
I think I read
done.
Between the lines there. Okay.
But in terms of an actual superhero comic, like if Marvel were to give me a,
and you have to do it.
I have to do it. I am. Believe me, I think it'll be a life changing thing. It's hard to pitch on an old character though, especially one that's owned by a big company. And it's one of those things. I'm not really a name, and if I could team up with a big known writer, maybe I could maybe get a little bit further ahead. But I've never actually gone through the process of a pitch, so I don't know what it entails really. But I've got some friends in the industry that I'm certainly going to bounce the story off of. But if it was Marvel or DC, I mean, I'm not sure. I've always been a Longbow Hunters guy, like the Longbow Hunters era Green Arrow. So yes, I'd love to do something with Ollie. But for Marvel, I'd love to do The Thing. But The Thing is kind of like my white whale. He's kind of like my Ahab and Moby Dick. Like, I love the character, but I bet you I draw him correctly once every 10 drawings I do of him. There's a challenge to drawing The Thing that comes with drawing some of those classic characters, where part of me wants to draw him in that round kind of cartoon goofy eye style that like Kirby made look so impressive. But then I love the way John Byrne drew The Thing, and he drew the thing in a totally different way. And then I love Ron Wilson, which is kind of like in between, and You know, there's, you know, do you go with the forehead brow ridge? Do you not? Is it a separate piece? Is it just a the way John Byrne did it, which was kind of almost came down like a baseball cap?
You got to do it the Mike Ruth way.
Well, that's the hard thing. It's trying to find that way, right? So I've had a few successes drawing the thing, but he'd be my guy. Mm-hmm. I'd love to do a Thing wrestling story, just because I'm a giant wrestling guy too. So I'd love to do, or I used to be a wrestling guy. I don't feel like I'm really in touch with the wrestling world anymore.
That's the
but,
three of us at this table.
Get that conversation.
But yeah, no, the Thing, I love the Thing as a wrestler during the 80s. I love that comic book so hard, and I'd love to do a return to that. That'd be so much fun.
I don't know why, but I feel like you would be perfect for a Thor book too.
Oh, just I'd love that, to do that, Thor
that
book.
Whole Viking.
Yeah,
like,
that's a good call.
I read like the Jason Aaron Thor, and I see the Esad Ribic work, and I think how you draw Conan and the Vikings. I'm like, you'd be perfect for this, at least for covers. And I mean, even Exo Manowar.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. Well, you got amazing. I mean, you saw Ribic. I mean, that guy is incredible. I watch him draw, and I want to quit. I want to break my brushes and just quit forever because he's just so good. And Thomas Girello, who's drawing the Exo series right now, but he also did that amazing King Conan story for Dark Horse last year. It was incredible. It was the best Conan story I've read in years. It was a 4 or 5 issue limited series. It was incredible. The artwork was unbelievable. Oh man, I just loved it so much. And I was so lucky because at the same time that was coming out, Headlopper was coming out, and you had the Jason Aaron Thor stuff happening, which was like old King Thor is one of the most genius ideas. Yeah. And it's, I just love that Thor basically becomes Odin in the later years. And I love the way, I mean, the fact that it was drawn by Ribic made it incredible, just incredible. Yeah, man, I loved Jason Aaron's whole story. I have to say, I was a little disappointed with the the unworthy Thor. Mm. Not because I didn't think the story wasn't amazing. I've just been one of these guys who, like, I've been watching the Marvel Universe slip through my fingers the past few years. It all began with issue like 600 of the Hulk. Basically, it was kind of when the first time I actually threw a comic book into a lake with rage. And after that, I kind of just had this bitter attitude. And then they started doing all these things in Marvel that just kind of. And the Thor books by Jason Aaron were the only thing that were holding me in the Marvel Universe. I knew that. And then Leonard Kirk, of course, is incredible. Like, I loved his run on the FF, but I hated that it was the end of the FF. And I understand why, and I think it's a stupid reason, but I totally understand why. But, like, I love Leonard's work, and he was absolutely the right guy to draw that that final story with the FF. But Marvel's been slipping through my fingers. And then the final thing that I actually gave a shit about was the whisper, the legendary whisper that Fury gives Thor way back a few years ago, which caused Thor to drop his hammer. And you know, then led to Jane Foster becoming Thor and all this other stuff, which has been awesome too. But they finally revealed what the whisper was, and I don't want to reveal it. I know it's just, I don't, just in case anyone out there hasn't read it. But man, pick up Thor Unworthy number 5, and a lot of people love the solution. They love the whisper. To me, it didn't make any sense. To me, it was a major letdown, and literally that was my last pinky hold on the Marvel Universe. I collect the books that my friends are drawing or working on out of a sign of respect and because I just enjoy their work. But I haven't collected a Marvel regular series in quite some time, with the exception of The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl. And the only reason I read that book is because it makes me laugh so hard every time I read it. It makes me really enjoy comics at their core. I think Ryan North is telling an incredible story. I think it's funny. The footnotes at the bottom of each page, the art style with Erica is unbelievable. My wife loves the comic, but like, I'm not reading Marvel anymore, and it breaks my heart, man. I used to go there as a kid to visit when things were really hard or sad or fucked up, you know, in my life, and I would go to the Marvel Universe to find solace. And now I just go to the Marvel Universe and I feel like a stranger in a strange land, and it's not a good feeling. I miss it. I miss what it used to be. And I know you can get back to that, but man, after the New 52 thing too, like, that was those are my last days at DC. My last moments of reading a DC comic was the dawn of New 52, and for many people that was their first time reading DC. So it's just one of those things where I'd rather not rant about it online and be angry about things. I'd rather just go and seek out other options. So, like, when all that money I was spending on DC, when New 52 came, all that money went to discovering new indie projects and Image Comics and, you know, Oni Press stuff and, you know, and Aftershock stuff and then all these new voices that were coming out, right? So, It was a good thing for me, but I just feel sad because I missed the Thing. I'm glad the Thing is still part of the Marvel Universe. I know he's on, I think he's on Guardians of the Galaxy now, which makes right. total sense to me because Ben Grimm always wanted to be a spaceman. So in the, you know, my feeling is I'm glad the Thing still has a job, but I miss Marvel's first family. I feel like you can't have that universe without them because that universe began. It began in the Marvel Universe.
It's big.
I mean, you think about Spider-Man number one, they put the Fantastic Four on the cover because they didn't think, they thought the power of the FF would be enough to sell it if Spider-Man himself couldn't.
Right.
You know, I mean, that says something right there. They're the first family in Marvel. Like, that's where it began, 1961. So...
speaking of other companies, the other choice, if I were to make one, would probably be Eternal Warrior from Valiant.
That's another good one, too.
I think that you would just absolutely kill that. And
I've been lucky enough to be asked to draw commissions for people of the Eternal Warrior, and I love the character. I loved the character back in the 90s when Valiant first showed up. I didn't have a lot of Valiant books back then. I loved Archer and Armstrong in those days. I bought it for the Barry Windsor Smith art. But I only had a few scant issues. And I loved Exo Manowar because I loved Bob Layton stuff and I loved the Bart Sears work. I mean, there was great stuff happening. But yeah, I loved when Valiant came back that first 2 years or so that they first came out swinging again. Man, it was incredible. Like, I was buying all their titles. I've had to drop them just for financial reasons. I've had to drop a lot of comics. But I know I picked up the recent Exo stuff mainly because of Thomas Giarello's artwork. But my God, it's so good.
It's really great.
I love it, man.
Valiant has been, we rave about it all the time. It's something I discovered last year, and I can't believe that I mean, there's not enough people reading it to tell you, like, hey, read this. It's awesome. But man, I can't recommend it enough.
Well,
it's a great pick.
In terms of, like, industry, my knowledge of them in the industry, I've never worked for them, but everyone I know who's done anything for them has just raved about what a great company they are and just what marvelous people they are. And I love their universe. I love their characters. They have really interesting stuff. I think that's really where I'm going to find my happiness now as a fan of comics, because I'm not finding it at Marvel. And I don't want it to seem like I'm down on all things Marvel. I'm really not. I get excited when the movies come out too, and I love, there's that little part of me that loves to see that these things have made it so far. These things that we used to fold up and smuggle out of our houses for fear of being beaten up by the jocks, like this kind of stuff, you know. It's an amazing time.
We have inherited the earth.
Yeah, and I don't want to ever take that for granted either. But sometimes they just do such abysmal work with those characters; it just makes you want to scream. And that's why it's nice to be able to go into a new universe like Aftershock. Like, man, Animosity. If you guys are not reading it, it's an incredible story.
Yeah.
And it's from the perspective, basically, of an aging bloodhound who's taking care of this young girl who's trying to save her and get her away from a bad situation because the world has been turned upside down because animals have all woken up in unison and realized that human beings are not fit to live on this planet. And that's essentially what the story is about. It's a pretty amazing story. Yeah. I think it could go into TV. I think it could really stretch and go lots of places. And it's because it's just an original idea with fresh characters. You don't need 75 years of Batman history to enjoy this book. You can just pick up it. I mean, Rough Riders, again, Adam Glass's book with artwork by, I'm going to get his name right. I think it's Patrick Olaf does the artwork. The guy is unbelievable talent. And I picked up Rough Riders at issue 7. Picked it up randomly because I was curious about it and I loved Aftershock stuff. You know, issue 7. When's the last time you went and picked up a new comic at issue 7, picked it up and read it and actually understood what was happening and enjoyed the hell out of it?
Yeah.
The way they write comics now is so different than when you were a kid. You used to be able to pick up issue 42 of...
That was a smart thing.
Whatever, and within three pages, you knew who the characters were, you knew what the point was.
They were all jumping on points.
Yeah, you know. Every one, that's the whole idea. Now you can't do that, really.
You
kind of have to get the trades, and I love reading trades, too, but I miss the idea of... I mean, there's a lot of stuff that passed me by as a kid, but, like, a friend of mine years ago, Josh Deck, he's a great artist as well, he got me turned back onto Valiant, actually, when they came back, but one of the things he pointed out to me was from Marvel, a comic called Strike Force Morituri, which I completely ignored growing up because it just seemed like something I wasn't into. Man, he gave me these comics, and, like... I couldn't believe how good they were. And, like, you know, the first 6 issues in, you're totally invested in this main character that the whole comic is from his perspective. Yep. And then he dies. He dies while you're reading his thoughts. And you're thinking, whoa, where did we go from here? And the comic went on for, like, another 30 issues or something like that.
Is that the New Universe?
No, it was actually, it wasn't New Universe, but it was around that time.
That time, yeah.
I love the New Universe. DP7 was an incredible comic. I love those books, too.
Good call.
Again, it was fresh, good stuff with great talent making them, right? So... Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I'm one of those guys that mostly will buy a comic for the artists, especially because I've gotten to know quite a few of them over the years, and they're such awesome people, you know. So that's kind of where my money goes now. Is if I know I'm directly affecting the income or the livelihood of someone I know, it makes it all the easier to, you know, to go down that road. But yeah, my Marvel collection for the past few years is just like dotted singles here and there that are not connected to anything that I just bought because a friend of mine drew this or wrote that or whatever, right? So
I think the cool thing though nowadays is that in the case of Marvel, even though if you're not into their new stuff, they're publishing or reprinting all of the stuff that we grew up reading, and you can, there's so much undiscovered things that you could get back into that weren't printed or that you couldn't have access to. So in that way, it's still a viable like place to go for your comics.
Sure,
but
sure.
You're right about today. It's so event driven to the point where you can't read just a Captain America. You got to read Captain America and what he's doing in a stupid.
Well, I mean that's story, that was part, and they did that in the '90s too. And I used to fall trap for that stuff in the '90s as well. Only they were actually back then. I feel like that's one big difference between the Marvel Universe now and the Marvel Universe then. I mean, when I was a kid, you could pick up an issue of, like, West Coast Avengers, and there'd be some character that would show up in that issue of West Coast Avengers that wouldn't make sense to you at the time because you just read that person's adventure in another, their own book that month, and then they would actually have a disclaimer. Well, if you're reading this and confused, it's because these events take place before issue 5 of Moon Knight or whatever,
right.
And all of a sudden you're like, oh, okay, well, now I can read, you know. But now it's just like, you'll have a character like Thunderbolts was developing this idea that the villains could become heroes, and maybe some of them would actually get into the idea of being a hero. And one of those characters was the Shocker, the classic Spider-Man right. villain. Yeah. And there was a point in time where he kind of is a squad leader in Thunderbolts, and he's like, you know, this is actually kind of cool. I kind of get why heroes do this. The feedback is nice. It's nice to actually save the day right. yeah. and feel good and the also get paid and then and also get a pardon. And then, like, a couple days later, they decide they want to have the Marvel Spider-Man Island event, and all of a sudden the Shocker has six arms and he's a Spider-Man villain again. And to me, it was just like, aren't these writers even communicating? Right. Like, yeah. I mean, what a great opportunity to draw a six-armed Shocker. I get it. But months before, he's actually turning around. You know what I mean? Yeah. There's another light. You're getting another dimension of a character. And I think sometimes you lose that now because you've got just this massive universe that's being spread so thin between so many great thinkers that, you know, it's... I just remember when everyone seemed like they were on the same page when I was a kid. Maybe that's why the place seemed more familiar and more friendly.
Right.
You know, I didn't collect Captain America all those years, but I knew what was going on. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's true.
Valiant feels like that right now.
Yeah, that's how Valiant feels. Oh, yeah. If you read,
very cohesive.
Yeah, they're all tied together, and that's very beautiful. Cohesive. Without the need for you to go and buy all those books,
you actually
buy them because you want to.
Yeah,
you know, and that's I think the difference.
It's interesting about these aftershock comics that are coming out. They're very distinct. There is a lot. I think even more so these days, you have so much, as you were touching upon, access to all these older classic stories. Something has to really be brilliant these days to bring in those dollars, or else you're spending it on these older trades that you know are tried and true.
Yeah.
Whereas these Aftershock, they're very intriguing. So well, I think that's something that's...
That's true, and I think that's kind of another testament to the great stuff that Aftershock's doing right now, because, you know, I mean, speaking as a guy who used to work in a comic book shop, I mean, it was really hard to convince the people that signed my checks to go and invest in an up-and-coming indie book. I mean, I can vouch to the creators till I'm blue in the face about how great they are and how talented they are, but if it ain't Spider-Man, it ain't Batman, it doesn't have any history behind it, it's a risk for any retailer to take that book on.
Right.
I was the kind of guy who would stand there in the store and be like, well, I see you're buying this, you might want to give this a try. Like, I was never pushy about it, but I was always trying to show that there was another option. If you like horror, you don't feel like you have to buy this horror book because there's all these great horror books over here that you might like. And so it's tough. It's really tough. So when you see a company like Aftershock that's kind of coming in like a comet with all these great new titles, and every month there's a new surprise. I mean, there's some stuff coming down the road which I'm super excited about, and you know, and the stuff that they've just announced, like the Jimmy's Bastards, the new Garth Ennis stuff, and you have this, I mean, the Unholy Grail coming, that which is the one, Cullen Bunn. I mean, he's the guy doing Conan the Slayer right now, and I mean, he's doing a great job with that, too. So I'm excited about it. I love the idea of a darker twist on the King Arthur mythos. It's been such a glossy, misty, pink unicorn, right. You know, land of fairy tales for so long, but it was about a guy with a brutally powerful sword and, you know, the legends that can come with having that kind of power. I think it's going to be really interesting to see. I'm excited about it. But, there's some great alternatives out there for sure. Comics are in a really healthy place, I think, in that regard. But people have to be willing to take that risk and say, hey, you know, I want to do this. You know, I want to try this new road. I mean, I did. All they had to do was start killing my heroes, and you know, it's like when it comes to wrestling. Like I mostly read my old Pro Wrestling Illustrated magazines because I go right back to 1988 or 1987 or 1991 when
you still have them.
Oh yeah, WCW was off the hook in 89 to 91. You had Dr. Death, Steve Williams.
That's another podcast.
We have to do. We could do a pure wrestling one.
We could do an absolutely pure wrestling one if you wanted to. But yeah,
please.
But
we need to schedule that.
Yeah.
I have some writing questions for you.
Sure.
That people want me to ask. So one of them was, you had mentioned you went to art school.
Yep.
So what was your worst grade in art school? Did you think it was fair? And was it a motivation, or was it did it hang over your head?
Well, how did it affect you? That's a great question, and I can think of what it is too, because my first year, you see, when you grow up and you have any sense that you have any kind of talent in art, and you become that kid in class that can draw, and then you go to a bigger school and you're still that kid in class that can draw, but there's another kid that also draws. Uh-huh. And then you get to high school and you're that kid that can draw, but there's four other guys in your class that can also draw, and there's this girl that draws really awesome too. And as the world gets bigger, you realize that you're not as special as you thought you were, and the competition starts to get pretty serious. And I remember going, not like I was cocky, but going into Sheridan College a couple years older than all of my friends, because it took me 3 years to, I had to move out of my parents' house and work and do all these things to prove to the government that I was worthy of a student loan. So they finally gave me a student loan. So by the time I got to school, I was 3 or 4 years older than most of my peers. So I'd already gotten all my drinking in and figured out how to live a little bit as an adult. So I was having all kinds of fun. But yeah, we got into painting class, and our first assignment was we had to take a common household item, I think, and just do it, some kind of distortion with it and do a painting of it. And I just did like I took a coat hanger and I kind of twisted it into this kind of demon dragon shape and did this painting of this coat hanger, and I brought it in, and he graded us that day at the end of the class while we were working on another assignment, and we got our grades back, and I lost my mind because he gave me a 4 out of 10. And I had always had pretty good marks, and I here I am, my first grade in college, and I got a 4 out of 10, and I kind of like, what do you mean 4 out of 10? Like, I kind of lost my mind over it. But he was like, no, it's not a very good painting. And he was just very cut and dry about it. But I think he was trying to give it, he didn't give anybody a mark over 6 that day.
Okay.
He was trying to kind of humble us all, to make us realize that the world's actually kind of shitty and mean when you get out there and you're making art for other people.
Right.
Because they don't care about your love or your passion about it. Well, sometimes they do. But right now I'm working with people that really actually want me to be happy with what I'm doing, because they know that produces the best work. But in the corporate world, that's not true. In the real world, that's not true. So yeah, I got a 4 out of 10 on a painting, and it made me insane with rage. And yeah, it did inspire me, because that made me realize I wasn't going about things the way I needed to succeed in this class, at least to impress the so-called painting teacher that we had at the time. I won't mention his name because he's, I don't know, he's probably not listening to this, but he was not a well-liked guy when we were in school because of his attitude.
Right.
And he himself was a terrible painter, we all thought. I mean, the first day of class, we'd ask him about how to paint a thing, and he'd say, well, you should consult that textbook I told you to buy. You know, it was one of those kind of, like, we didn't get our real painting teachers until we had Catherine McDonald in year two, and we had the mighty, incredible, my sensei, Carrie Kim, in year three, who is an unbelievable painter to this day. My God, if I had had him in first year, I'd be a different painter today. But we had him in third year, and it was great. But sorry, that was a long answer.
No, I think that was good.
It's a good answer.
Another one was, do you have any tattoos? How many? And when they're doing the tattoo art on your arm, are you in your head criticizing how they're doing it?
Tattooing is something I've often thought about, but I'm a bit too squeamish a person to start cutting into people and making permanent marks on them. I know how often the eraser is in my hand when I'm drawing on paper, so it's not a game I want to play on someone's flesh, even though, you know, you're working from a fairly standard template in a lot of places. I know some super talented guys. Yes, I do have tattoos. All the tattoos I have been designed by myself, so if I don't like them now, which is in the case of a couple of them, I only have myself to blame and my inexperience and my eagerness to get a tattoo. My most recent one is about 10 years old now. It says Hammer of Thor on my wrist, which has also become my brand and my business card and things like that. I sneak it into pieces of artwork. I have a really poorly drawn band on my arm. Like a Celtic knotwork band that never got finished because the guy doing it was a heroin addict, and I wasn't aware until I was halfway through the tattoo that things were kind of going sideways. But he was a tremendously talented artist. He just had a bad problem. I have a tattoo. The first tattoo I got is on my other shoulder, and it's of a crab, kind of done in a Celtic knotwork style. It looks a little bit like Goldberg's tattoo, but it was put on me a few years before Goldberg was a thing. So, and then across my back, I have in the Motorhead font, I have the word Uncouth written on my back. Uncouth Ruth was my nickname in college, and it became a legacy when I found it. It was also my dad's nickname when he was a young man, so that was a weird kind of thing. But yeah, Uncouth Ruth is where you find me on Instagram and Twitter, but it's also written on my back in the Motorhead font.
Nice. Awesome. Any more questions for you?
I think I'm good. So yeah. Thanks for joining us today. And you mentioned Twitter and Instagram. Where else can people find you if they're looking for any work being done?
Well, I have my shop online, which is just mikeruth.bigcartel.com. Which there's not a whole lot of new stuff up there right now because I've been so busy, but I will be posting some stuff soon. Twitter, I'm Uncouth Ruth. Facebook, I'm just my own name, Mike Ruth. There's a picture of Oopla the Mock from Thunder the Barbarian as my profile picture. In case you come across another Mike Ruth, but you may not. I think there are a few of them out there. Yeah, and you'll see me at some Comic Cons this year too. I've got a very reduced schedule. I have Niagara Falls Comic Con in June, which is one of my favorite shows. It's kind of my hometown show because I grew up in St. Catharines nearby. I also have the East Coast Comic Expo, which is Nick Bradshaw's hometown show in Moncton. And I'm looking forward to that. It's only a one-day show, but it also corresponds with my wife's and mine's 10th anniversary, wedding anniversary. So we're going to go and spend a few days in Prince Edward Island and drive around the East Coast a little bit in a rented car. I am booked at Heroes Con, but given the recent trouble so many of my friends seem to be having traveling across the border to do American shows, I'm not sure it's worth my risk at this point. I also don't know that I can afford the trip. I am not able to take on pre-orders like I normally do, because Heroes is a wonderful show, but it's not one that I typically make a lot of money at, mainly because the cost of doing the show is so high. Not the show itself, but just, you know, living in Charlotte for 5 days, feeding yourself, hotels, the plane tickets, it adds up very quickly. But there's also this added factor now of the current administration in the States, which is kind of seems to be making things, what's already kind of a tricky gamble, seem a little bit tougher now. The restrictions crossing the border have become pretty extreme. I've had people who have been treated so miserably at the border, so brutally, that they won't even speak about it, and other people who've been pretty public about their experiences. I've been rattled a few times at the border, but I typically get through okay. But I'm not sure I want to risk it for Heroes this year. The cost is high. I'd rather save my money and take my chances in New York City in October. I missed New York last year. It's a fantastic show. There's really nothing else like it. And this year, if I go, I have a free place to stay with a friend in the Bronx, so which is makes the show a viable option for me if I get accepted this year. I wasn't accepted last year. Other than that, I have Fan Expo, hopefully, in September, which has become my best show, I think, because of the Toronto is just doing a lot of things right now. The Artist Alley has done made some big changes. The show was great, so I'm looking forward to that. But yeah, it's a very reduced schedule, and part of the reason I'm not able to take on commissions to do some of these shows is because I'm busy doing stuff for Aftershock Reach now, which is kind of great. There's a lot of stuff I can't talk about, but I've got a few covers on the go right now. Awesome. I do have one coming up for Gotham Central pretty soon, which will be their not their first, but they just had one for Pestilence come out, done by Nate Jones, who's an unbelievable artist. And I'll be doing one for a different title next month. So working on that at home right now, actually. Yeah. So you can find me on the road a little bit. You can also find me sometimes here in Oakville at Comic Connection on 490 Spears Road. And there's awesome guys there running that shop. Lance Rance on Instagram is my dude, my neighbor, and my. If you've met me at a comic show, at a Comic Con, you've met me only because Rob is taking care of my day job as a super while I'm at the Comic Con. So, if you've ever met me or got a commission from me, you can thank Rob. Rob Lance, he's the guy that's who makes all that happen. Really,
very awesome. Well, thanks again for being a friend of the Fastball Special
and the Cave of Solitude. Hey, long overdue. We're happy to have you on our show.
Hey, a pleasure anytime, guys. It's always fun.
All right. Cheers.
Take it easy.